This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 19th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 237 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up in today's programme, what if the First World War had never happened? We speak to an author who's come up with a vision of this alternative world. He doesn't only look at borders and nations, but also developments in music, visual arts and technology.
Then we speak to the man who's been in search for the sonic wonders of the world. Here, for example, we have singing sand dunes.
And we'll find out how to stuff a dead mouse as we explore taxidermy's resurgence.
All that plus Monocle's Tom Edwards will be here for a look at some of the big stories next week. We'll play a great track too. Lots to get through today. It is episode 237 of the Monocle Weekly. It is episode 237. What do you think? That's kind of the new statement of intent. It's 2014. Here we go, Andrew.
Singing sand dunes and stuffing a mouse.
Yeah.
Hold on to your seats, kids.
Exactly. We're basically auditioning for a job on one of those sofa programmes they have on the breakfast TV, don't they?
Is that one of those?
They all sit on a sofa and they go, well, anyway, 37 people died in Libya. Anyway, here's someone with... Someone's boobs are falling out of the Golden Globes.
It's like one of those ancient freak shows today, I think.
It is a bit. It's Victoriana through and through. And some serious stuff, I expect, as well. I think that what happened in the First World War didn't happen. They might throw up some serious
I'm looking
topics.
Forward to that. And you're off to Italy.
Yeah, I am. Later today, I'm off. And it's a bit of a bummer. I mean, everyone hates working on a Sunday, Andrew, don't they? Especially when they have to go and see AC Milan versus Verona at the San Siro Stadium. That's what I'm doing tonight. What do you think about that? For work.
I wonder why you suddenly commissioned yourself to do a big feature. No, good.
So that's going to be cool. That's going to be part of our themed issue for March, isn't it? Our Italy-themed issue.
Yeah, we have a big Italian issue. So we've done, the last couple of years, we did a German issue last year, and it was a Lusophone Portuguese-speaking world issue the year before that.
Yeah.
And now, our attention's turned to Italy.
Forza Italia. And so that's going to be a cool thing. The reason I'm going is not just to, throw pies at some Italians and things on the pitch from up in the gods. It's to do to profile Gazzetta dello Sport, which is one of Italy's top-selling newspapers. It's entirely a sport newspaper. Of course, in the winter, mostly a football newspaper. And it's going to be amazing, I hope, to see how this great match turns into a newspaper the next day. So that's the point of me going there, just in case you wondered.
No, good. I was in Milan at the last weekend. We were there because we do an event during the Men's Fashion Week. But what was interesting is, you always think about this world of fashion. We met some amazing people, including this guy who is the biggest maker of quality shirting. And every single company you can think of that makes shirts, he makes the shirting for. And they've done it since the 1800s. And they own the whole process from the cotton fields in Egypt right the way through to the kind of distribution. And a really amazing man. And it's funny when you meet those businesses behind the world of fashion, you realise what a kind of industrial, technical world it is. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that issue.
That sounds like a story I want to read. From Egypt to the well-serviced shelves of Milan, menswear shelves of Milan. That sounds
to the
cool.
Wardrobe of Robert Bound.
That'll be me. Hello.
We could end up there in the closet. I don't think so. That's unlikely.
I'm not getting back into it.
Well, you've never been in it. So shall we move on?
shall we awkwardly seg?
Yeah, let's do awkwardly seg. It's too much explanation. We need footnotes almost now.
Yeah, exactly. We do. We need asterisks. Coming up next, of course, with his own theme tune, it could only be one man. That is Monocle's Tom Edwards.
It's Sunday, it's midday, live from London. This is the Monocle Weekly. And with his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
I asked him to take the clapping off that.
I know. Why would you do such a thing? I'd like a more of a rousing ovation.
I know. I think it's...
Maybe some whistles.
I think you need it afterwards, depending upon how good the news look ahead was.
Oh, that's high pressure.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Andrew. How are you both?
Very good, thank you.
Yeah, I'm all right.
Good.
We're perky.
Oh, that's good. So I didn't mean to sound so surprised.
That's the way Andrew's sitting.
It's often the way.
What's on the top of the news charts for next week?
Well, I thought we'd start today. Russia's fan law comes into effect today. This is a fan law.
You can't use fans in the street anymore. It's too ladylike.
it's too ladylike.
Oh, that's. I better not go there then.
No, it's tackling. No, another one of your problems. It's tackling football hooliganism.
Okay.
I've seen you on the terraces, bound.
Yeah.
It's not pretty. 2018 FIFA World Cup. Obviously, everyone's talking about Brazil this year. The problems they're facing. Will it be ready? Stadiums collapsing. All very serious. In Russia, they're more worried apparently about fan behaviour. The Russian Sports Ministry says there have been in the last 3 years at sporting events. How many disturbances do you think? Just in 3 years.
The last 3 years in the Russian league.
In Russia.
30.
Rob?
130.
14,000?
So wow.
I don't know what they've been drinking over there. But
I do.
It's not a pretty picture. So Russia's fan law comes in, swinging changes. You better be on your best behaviour if you're at the soccer in Sochi, for example.
Man.
Okay. Rob, you actually look physically pained then.
Well, that pun.
Yeah, sorry. That came to me. It wasn't prepared. It's terrible, isn't it?
That's quite amazing. We don't really have an idea of Russian football hooliganism, do we? Because I guess, English teams, there's probably we play one Russian team.
Dynamo, exactly, and they're generally on their best behaviour, I guess, because a lot of their fans don't travel. But it's a bit of a different case over there. I mean, of course, I guess if you were being slightly cynical about it, you could say, well, what is classed as an incident of hooliganism in Russia.
Well, but I don't think it's like prodding your neighbour in the with your elbow
Well, it might be sort of clearing your throat in
the Russians are a bit,
anti-Putin fashion, in which case that would explain this particularly high numbers. But
yeah,
interesting to watch, that. I think.
That's interesting. Mm. Okay, we'll watch that space, shall we, on that?
You look pleased with the first one, anyway.
Well, that was a relatively positive start.
Let's do...
That's good. Little one for that. Okay, let's run through a couple quickly. So tomorrow, Paris Fashion Week.
Yep.
It's been very much, it's a sort of the fashion season.
That's why you're dressed like this.
Monocle's team. Well, what, in my birthday suit? I'm not. I'm wearing a proper outfit, of course. It's a Sunday. Sunday best, Andrew, for me always. But we've obviously been following the scene. Lots of exciting things happening, obviously, in Florence, Milan. Paris's turn the week ahead. And we'll be keeping abreast of that, finding out.
Presumably, there's going to be lots of Russian fashion designers walking around with a fan. Because they're not
allowed
to do it at home.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Do you know
I'll stitch those two together brilliantly.
That was seamless.
Yeah.
As you would want in the world of fashion.
And you'll need to be wearing more than your blacksmith's apron.
I have nothing in response to that. Let's talk about a serious news story tomorrow. The P5 plus one world powers in Iran actually kick off their deal on the nuclear program from tomorrow. So sanctions rolled back. It's a bit of a mixed bag. It's quite picky. It's not going to constitute enormous relief for Iran, but it's symbolic nonetheless. And Iran obviously rolling back on various aspects of their nuclear development program. That actually starts tomorrow. So all of the stuff, all of the debate, the talks, all of the wrangling, action happens tomorrow.
I wonder if they put that on the badge, P5 plus one. Might make do that just a little button, I think.
No, yeah. I'd go for that. Okay. Maybe we should suggest that to them for the next round of talks.
I think they need a rebrand.
Yeah.
That's not really...
Or just add it up. Six.
P6.
keep building it until you get a P45.
I was going to say that, but I thought, no, it's rubbish.
And it's the joke is only relevant in the UK as well.
Yes. For our international listeners, that's what you get when you get the boot.
In the UK.
In the UK only. Let's keep going. So Wednesday, Davos. Yeah. The World Economic Forum, of course, gets underway. The theme this year, are you interested to know what that would be?
Is it money?
Money, how to make it,
keep it, not let anyone else in.
The reshaping of the world, : consequences for society, politics and business.
What shape is it going to be in the future?
AKA
then?
Money.
I think it is, yeah.
Okay.
What shape? I don't know, ovoid,
okay.
I would imagine. And should we finish with another?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thursday, 23rd. Tokyo governorship. Interesting race for the governorship of the city this year, succeeding Naoki Inoue, because former Prime Minister Hosokawa has thrown his hat into the ring, and he's backed by another former Prime Minister, Junichiro Koizumi, very, very popular. And Hosokawa a bit of a veteran. He's in his 70s. He's a potter now. He's been out of frontline politics for 20 years.
Has he got an apron?
He'll definitely potter's have an apron. He'll definitely have a potter's apron and a wheel when he rolls into town. He is strongly anti-nuclear ticket. Very popular. Will be quite a sort of fresh.
So is he throwing his hat or his fan into the ring?
A hat and a fan.
Okay.
It's a whole.
Remember where we are.
He's got all the accoutrements. But what's interesting?
If he doesn't
win
after this, then I'll be surprised.
No, you'll eat your hat and your fan.
Yeah.
But he. So the Tokyo governorship, the city of Tokyo, is a major shareholder of the metropolitan government in TEPCO, the embattled nuclear provider. So obviously, if he is returned to run that metropolitan authority on an anti-nuclear ticket, and is then one of the key controlling shareholders in TEPCO, potential conflict of interest, very interesting, and lots of people that I've spoken to in Japan are very excited to see could he win, and how unsettling would that be? The vote takes place at the start of next month.
That's an interesting roundup. Thank you so much. There's a lot in there for people to
busy.
Take
it was
home.
Busy. It was fast and furious.
I think that's almost a further reading news
definitely.
Ahead.
I'm definitely going to find out more about Russian hooliganism.
And the fans.
Football fans.
They must have some amazing, tattoos, the football hooligans.
Have you ever read any of those volumes of Russian criminal tattoos?
No, but I've,
fascinating. I have one. I'll bring it in. You can read it. It's encyclopedic. Extraordinary stuff.
Yeah. It's like, this means he went to this prison, and he serves in this gang, and he's da 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 da. It's
absolutely.
Amazing, isn't it?
And it's all represented often in a very sort of subtle way. Sort of be like, a dagger held in a certain way means something very different if it's held facing to the east, for example, or whatever. Incredibly complex.
And what does your butterfly mean?
I'm glad you noticed that. Obviously, that's normally away from prying eyes. It just means I'm a bit of a free spirit, Andrew.
Tom Edwards, thank you very much for your news. Look ahead.
As we approach the centenary of the First World War, everyone is looking back at the events that changed the world permanently. The National Archives in the UK just announced that it was putting the diaries from British soldiers in the conflict online. Britain, France and Belgium are also getting ready to host a series of events to commemorate the war over the next 4 years. And Germany is still facing something of a discussion about how it should remember the war.
Our next guest has chosen to investigate the war by writing a book that offers us insight into the world now that we now inhabit if the conflict had never happened. The book, Archduke Franz Ferdinand Lives, A World Without World War I, doesn't only cover the most obvious angles like politics and ethnicity, but also the ones that may seem more difficult to grasp: music, visual art, medical developments and technology.
Author of the book, Richard Ned Lebeau, Professor of International Politics Theory in the Department of War Studies at King's College London, joins us in the studio now. Well, welcome to the show, Ned.
Thank you very much.
Now, many historians, and I know that you were hinting before you started that there's been some little controversy around the book already, are cautious about looking back over events and wondering the what if something hadn't happened. Why have you been brave to kind of step into this world and imagine, what would have happened if the First World War hadn't taken place?
There are two reasons for considering what ifs. If you say that X caused Y, other things being equal, no X, no Y. So any causal inference, which historians are always making, requires you to consider the counterfactual. They rarely do, or if they do, they smuggle it in and don't do it very well. Now, I'm using counterfactuals here for a different purpose. I'm asking, what were the consequences of World War I? Well, we can't rewind the tape of history and see what would happen in its absence. We can't access an alternate universe, so all we can do is consider it counterfactually. So what I do is to construct what I consider to be the best and worst worlds that might have resulted in the absence of World War I, not to argue that they would have occurred, but rather they're the envelope in which any historical world would be found, and they offer us vantage points to look at and reflect back on the real world and ask why it occurred and how contingent it was. And that, I think, is a very defensible and necessary use of counterfactuals, of what-ifs.
In terms of what ifs, Ned, you said the best and worst possible worlds that might have come out of it. Let's look at the good news first, perhaps. What would have come out, or what were the good things? What were the main protagonists? Let's take it from a nation state point of view, perhaps first. What were those main protagonists have been doing in the 30s instead of readying themselves for war in the 40s.
So I argue that the turning point between the better and worse worlds is the constitutional development of Germany from about 1918 to 1925. And I construct a scenario, quite a realistic one, because it builds on an historical one. And it goes in two different directions. In the better world, the crisis is resolved in a way that moves Germany down the path toward a constitutional monarchy. As a result, more liberal forces prevail in Germany. There's certainly no Nazis. There's no World War II. There's no Holocaust. Germany gradually develops, and in such a way that the military and its values are seen as completely anachronistic by younger generations who spurn it and who basically look forward to a peaceful world where they can indulge themselves materially and socially. Britain and Germany and France all draw closer together. In this world, there is indeed a revolution in Russia, but not a Bolshevik coup, or at least not a successful Bolshevik coup, because Russia hasn't fought in 4 years of a destructive war. And gradually, democracy and development spread to Eastern Europe. You don't have, of course, Soviet communism, so in the absence of that, you don't have a division of Europe after World War II. And you have a world somewhat like what we have now.
I was going to say, it seems there is some...
Yes, it just comes earlier, it becomes earlier, and it's more successful. Now, there is, if I may, a downside to the positive world as well. Both world wars hastened development in medicine, science. Think about aviation. We wouldn't have, or it wouldn't have come as soon, safe long-distance air travel. We wouldn't have an information revolution. Antibiotics were developed and first used in World War II. They probably would have come a decade or two later because you wouldn't have had the massive investment in Britain, but even more so in the United States, in basic science.
Ned, that means, though, I guess, when you look at history, you're feeling that, you know, events control everything, that the economy controls everything. So, for example, in the case of, you know, what happens with the run-up to World War II in Germany, you know, it's seen as reparations being the cause for the kind of unease in Germany, that, you know, the Allied powers had asked for too much. You don't really put any credence in the idea that, you know, Hitler did exist, and many of the characters that shaped history, you know, they did exist. You don't feel that without these other events, they would have had any power whatsoever.
That's not my view. On two levels. One of the things I do in the book is look at counterfactual biographies, and I take people who were very prominent, and I show that some of them, like Churchill, to use an example, would have been equally prominent in a peaceful, better world or in the worse world, but they would have acted differently because of the context.
But I think we have Hitler running an alternative medicine company.
Well, we do. So think about why Hitler was able to come to power. In the first place, you had the defeat of Germany in the First World War, which was seen as a humiliation by most Germans. Secondly, you had an unsuccessful socialist revolution that basically plighted its troth with the army because it was more fearful of the communists on the left. So the right was never chastened. It increased its power throughout Weimar. It played on the socialists signing the peace treaty, accusing them and the Jews of being traitors. And when an economic crisis came, there was a space for a party like Hitler's, and especially a charismatic leader by Hitler, like Hitler, to have a chance of coming to power. But remember, Hitler never won more than 32% of the vote. And when Hitler became chancellor in January of 1933, the public opinion polls had shown that Nazism had peaked, that the movement was on the decline. So one doesn't have to invoke terribly much contingency to keep Hitler out of power. Now, in the historical world, had Hitler not come to power, you still would have had a nasty right-wing regime in Germany, and it probably would have started a revisionist war in the East against Poland. But all kinds of other things, including the Holocaust, would never have occurred.
Ned, I wanted to ask you, you're in an interestingly named department at King's College in London, the War Studies Department, right? This is obviously a book about what would happen if the war hadn't happened. Clearly, you have to know about war and peace to do that. Have you had to study the peace, or is it maybe learning about how the war was fought that you can decide what might not have happened if it hadn't happened?
Well, in the...
That sounds like a riddle, but you know what I mean.
In the five decades that I've been a university professor, I have studied both war and peace. And to study both, you have to understand the context in which they develop. And that requires understanding not only politics, but the broader zeitgeist, the cultural setting. So the two go together. And for the same reason, you might consider the War Studies Department at King's College is also the best peace studies department in the UK. In addition to historians who study military history, we have a group of people from diverse disciplines whose specialty is reconstructing societies in the aftermath of war, international lawyers who are interested in regulating conflicts and preventing wars, cyber warfare experts. It's quite a diverse department. And, of course, I love it because there are always people who know a lot more than I do about these things, and I can learn from them.
Ned, I often look at the dedication page in a book to wonder, you know, where some of the story sprang from. You have a dedication at the front of the book which says to Greg Massell, who would have had a less stressful life and longer-lived parents and brother in either counterfactual world. Can you just tell us a little bit behind
indeed,
that dedication?
Indeed, I'd be delighted to. Greg Massell is one of my closest friends. He's now 86. He grew up in Vilna, which was then Lithuania, formerly Poland, then it became part of the Soviet Union. He was out on a date with his girlfriend when the German bombers came to Vilna. He and his brother fled. His parents were rounded up and machine gunned in a forest together with other members of the Jewish population of the town. Gregory and his brother became partisans, and they were at one point caught in a crossfire between Soviet and German forces. And the last thing Greg remembered was seeing his brother blown up before he was knocked unconscious. He was recovered by the Soviets, and he spoke fluent Russian. He was nursed back to health, but as he didn't have papers, he was put in a punishment battalion, which was used to march through minefields. He managed to escape from that, got to Central Asia, became part of the regular Soviet army, fought his way back to Berlin, and his roommate for 3 days turned out to be some Ukrainian nationalist who was arrested and shot. Greg was then sent into the Gulag, and so he was in Siberia and Central Asia for 4 years, managed to get out, came to the U.S., worked as a stevedore for 2 years, got himself a scholarship to Harvard, where he did a B.A. and then a Ph.D. and then became a professor of Soviet studies. So his life and that of his family would have been enormously different had the world evolved
right.
differently. And he's in a way a stand-in for so many people who were or whose families were victims of those conflicts.
And I guess that he, like many people from that time, often asked themselves that question every day. What
yes.
if?
Yes, absolutely. And psychologists, and I wear my hat as a psychologist here, people invent counterfactuals, what if, every day to deal with ordinary problems, including evaluation. You know, if you think about your job, you might find another one, but if you think about your partner or your house, not so easy to swap, so you invent counterfactuals. And people invent two kinds of counterfactuals, upwards and downwards. And upward ones suggest the world could have been better, the counterfactual. Had I really studied for this exam, I could have gotten a good grade. Huh?
Yeah.
And if that's true, then it becomes an incentive to study for the next one. And the downward counterfactuals, there's nothing I could have done to have prevented this. Therefore, I don't need to feel any guilt or remorse.
We're going to leave it there. Ned LaBelle, thank you so much.
My great pleasure.
For coming on to the Monocle Weekly. The book is out now and it's called Archduke Franz Ferdinand Lives, A World Without World War One. Ned, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
All right, Andrew, it's time for a bit of music.
What you got for us?
I've got, this is a lovely song. This is, have you seen American Hustle?
No, not yet.
Okay, so there's a great scene in it, and this is a great track from the soundtrack. It is an Arabic version of White Rabbit, that sort of classic, sort of late 60s, early 70s Jefferson Airplane track, all about sort of Alice and psychedelia and, you know, all the rest of it. Bit of Victoriana there. Who'd have thought it could be rendered so beautifully in Arabic? This is my sort of slight topicality, sort of, it's a slightly themed thing, because obviously American Hustle's up for so many Oscars, it's well at the Golden Globes. So anyway, here she is. This is Maisa Kara singing White Rabbit. And that was Maisa Kara with her take on Jefferson Airplane's White Rabbit. And you can download that from the American Hustle soundtrack.
And if you stay with us, you can find out how to stuff it as well, because we're going to be talking taxidermy later on.
That's too good. That's brilliant. Andrew Tuck is on form. Stay tuned. What are we going to have next? We're going to be investigating sound.
Contemporary Czech designers are embracing age-old bohemian glassmaking traditions and mixing in new techniques to create modern products with soul. Monocle Films pays a visit to some of the country's most clear-thinking glass alchemists.
Original decoration, this is very difficult, and it must be about emotions. And if I'm teaching students, I'm speaking about mentality of glassmakers, that it's not good to be proud only. Artists must be humble too.
Clear Vision, Czech Glass. Now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
In everyday life, you rarely stop and just listen. It might be the sound of traffic, chirping birds, or it might be banging sounds coming through your neighbour's wall. Our next guest has celebrated them and some more unusual other sounds in his book, Sonic Wonderland, A Scientific Odyssey of Sound.
Along with these more common sounds, Professor and acoustic engineer Trevor Cox has been tracking down some of the world's most amazing acoustic phenomena, the most impressive and strangest sounds. And he joins us in the studio now. Hello.
Hi there.
And welcome. We've got some sounds coming up, but we perhaps should have had at least a drum roll for you there. It sounds like the most complicated task in the world, writing a whole book about sound.
I don't know. We listen to sounds all the time. We might just ignore them, which is what I think a lot of us do, unless it's music or speech. And I just decided to celebrate sound, to look out the most unusual. So, yeah, it's a bit of a... The book isn't a travelogue, but I did have to do quite a lot of travelling to find them.
And there's quite a few charts and graphs. It's got... You do come from a proper science background. You're trying to properly explain how these sounds work and their kind of effect on us in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a popular science book, so, the technical terms do appear, but they are all explained and hopefully in a way which makes it approachable. It is meant to be a book you would sit on the beach and read. It's not meant to be, you know, something you'd read as a textbook before you go and sort of do an examination. It is meant to be a fun read.
What Trevor's saying is, don't be afraid of the graphs.
Yes, that's what he's saying.
It's all right. I'm not afraid of a graph. I love a graph.
That's like a parental warning, isn't it? Technical terms do appear.
I wanted to ask you a bit of an open-ended one. Are there more or less? There's probably more sounds in the world because there's more things to make them, I guess. But do we notice them less because there's so much more music in the world? Do you think we can't? Our brains maybe can't process the stuff that's around us so easily.
Well, we're actually trained. I mean, our brains have kind of developed to ignore sounds in a funny way, or to pick out certain sounds. So our brain, in evolutionary terms, developed first as an early warning system, and we can't see behind us, and therefore we're dependent on our hearing to pick up the person creeping up from behind, you know, the sort of kind of the crack of the twig kind of effect. And so we have in our brains the ability to tune out stuff which is constant. So if you've got leaves rustling in a tree, or maybe in modern world, the car on the road next door, that's not very interesting information because it's not changing very much. So our brains naturally just filter that gradually out. So we do naturally try and ignore sounds which aren't remarkable or interesting.
Now, one of the chapters which appealed to me, because I do a show here called The Urbanist. If you haven't heard of it, you should do. It's all about cities. Constant plugging. It's all about cities. And one of the things that was fascinating in there was you were saying that, in fact, there's just so much more sound in a way in a city. It's much louder than it would have been some years ago, that the decibels have gone up. Again, does that make it quite hard? For you said there is this filtering process, but when things are just that much louder, how do we respond to that?
Well, actually, in cities in most recent decades, it hasn't got that much louder. I mean, since Industrial Revolution, things have got a lot louder because, of course, we had machines. And then, you know, over that time period, things have got definitely louder once machines arrived. In recent decades, the average level's about the same. But what's happened is we've lost the quiet periods. Because people, you know, you might do it if you drive anywhere in rush hour. You try and leave a bit earlier or a bit later. You try and go down the back roads. So the traffic pollution pervades a wider area and a wider time. So what we've lost is those quiet periods where you might be able to hear the birds songs, or you might hear snippets of conversations people go past, or the distant sound of children playing in playgrounds. Those are the sounds in the city that we kind of lost because we have allowed sort of this fog of sound to lie all over it.
Should we have some sounds?
Yes.
What should we have? We've got two gunshots, haven't we, Trevor? We've got one that has no echo and one that's got a humongous one. Should we have the one without one first? Should we have this is a gunshot in an anechoic chamber, a room designed to have no echo. Bit of an anticlimax there. Should we have that again?
I don't think it's an anticlimax.
That is an anticlimax.
Well, no, it isn't, because you're so used to hearing a gun going bang. Actually, it's just quite... I recorded it and went, is that it? Have I set my recorder wrong? Yeah, I think it's quite amazing to have it. But especially when you compare it to the next sound, which is taken in a ginormous oil tank.
Wow, and that is a gunshot in the Inchindown underground fuel depot in Scotland, and that was an attempt to break the Guinness World Record for longest echo. Did it win?
It did win, yes, it did. That's the same gun. I must point out...
We should point out also that that goes on for an extra minute.
Yeah. The recording's about a minute and 20 seconds, and then I stopped recording. And it's this huge space, which was actually built... It was buried into the side of a Scottish hill to hold oil in the 1930s, so it was protected from German bombing. So there's actually lots of those tanks there. There's six of them, if I remember rightly. And each of them are just vast sort of cathedral spaces. And they're not designed to go into. I mean, they used to be full of shipping oil. And to get into them, you have to go down the pipework. That's the only actual entrance into them. So you have to go into a pipe, which is about, I don't know, 18 inches in diameter. You have to be pushed through this pipework to get into it. And then inside, it has this just amazing sound. You know, if you yell there, it will just last a couple of minutes before it dies away.
Did you find on your travels and in the realm of natural sounds, if you like, anything that reminded you of music, anything that is musical?
I mean, a lot of natural sounds have come out sort of tonal. You know, they have a sort of distinct note to it. And particularly if you look at animals, you'll get stuff which...
Birdsong, I guess.
Birdsong's an obvious one. I think, you know, but there's more unusual ones. I think my favourite unusual one was a bearded seal, which has the most amazing sound. I mean, you have to put an underwater microphone in to get it. Mm. And it all just, it goes... and just makes this amazing sort of glissando, which just goes on and on and on and on. It's just kind of incredible sound.
Now, so I was going to say,
we should get a band together, shouldn't we?
Well, the next one could almost be a part of a band, because you've got here, this is a keyboard where each key triggers a rubber hammer to hit a particular stalactite in a cave. It's in the Luray Caverns in Virginia. Now, just tell us before we hear the sound why this one is a special.
Well, first of all, I think it's the only instrument I know which uses stalactites and cave formations. So, and it's also vast. I mean, it's across...
Okay, that's special.
Yeah, that's special. It's vast because it's across a large cavern. But it's also unusual because actually when it was made back in the 1950s, they had to go around and find which of these formations would ring nicely. And then they had to tune it, which means getting an angle grinder out and grinding the formation. So I think nowadays you'd never be able to do it. So it's probably unique now, and it's probably never likely to ever be reproduced.
And that was the great Stalagpipe organ.
Yeah, and he's got
pun intended in Luray Caverns in Virginia. Yeah. Our Paul Noble, who's behind the glass there, just said that's the opening bars to a Barry Manilow track.
Oh, is it?
Apparently,
oh,
it is. Yeah, he's just said he's our musical expert.
I believe it's a bit of Chopin originally, so maybe.
Really?
Maybe Barry Manilow's going to get sued by Chopin.
They're going to have to fight it out amongst themselves.
Actually, our Paul Noble, he can't tell the difference between the two. That's a problem.
I love the idea of that. I'd love to see your expenses claim for writing this book.
Yeah, I spent quite a lot of money, didn't I, travelling around? There's not much my advance left, I can tell you that for free.
One of the other nice things in the chapter about cities is you talk about the fact that there are endangered sounds. There are sounds that we're at risk of losing. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think your sounds kind of disappear without us kind of realising. And one of the things is birdsong. You know, birds are having to adapt their singing to actually get above the traffic noise. So you find that they start singing at different times of day and they actually have to sing at different frequencies. So quite a lot of birds, songbirds, you know, use low frequencies to signal, you know, I'm a good mate, come to me. But unfortunately, those are the exact frequencies that then get drowned out by the cars. So there is a suspicion that species, you know, that which species are successful in cities and which ones die out, it's partly down to which ones can actually sing above the traffic noise.
And the other one I always think is interesting is the sound of an office, how that has changed in like 10, 15, 20 years. You know, 20 years ago, you would have still had typewriters, people, phones ringing constantly on every single desk. You're in our office now, so much is done by email, you're encouraging people to use the phone. But sometimes, you know, your phone rings like once in a day because everybody is sending you an email. The offices seem to be a much quieter kind of oral landscape these days than they were before.
Yes, and it's the rattle of the keys, isn't it? Yeah. It's what you're kind of genuinely listening to. That creates problems in open plan offices because you actually want a bit of background noise to hide some of the conversation. So if someone does have a phone call...
You've heard Rob's conversations?
Yeah.
I was going to say, everyone's stopped drinking at lunchtime now in offices as well.
No, but, you know, if you don't have any background noise, then every single conversation in the office becomes really clear. And the thing is, a conversation has got useful information on it. You know, you may not want to listen to it, but your brain's going, oh, maybe something's there that I need to listen into, and it locks into it. It's very hard to ignore. So there are actually systems you can buy, I don't know if they're a good idea, which actually put noise into an office to try and blank out some of the sort of quiet conversations.
Should we have some more sound, Rob?
Yeah. I love that idea that you can get sound sort of pumped into offices. There's a story in that.
Off you go.
No, just going to do my work here, just my magazine work while I'm on the radio. We're going to have one final sound in two parts, I think, Trevor. Maybe you can cue us up. This is you. This is some dunes, some singing dunes.
Yeah, there's about 30 dunes that sing in the world, documented. There's probably a few more, but they haven't been documented. Not many people go into the middle of deserts. And this is the Mojave Desert in California, in the middle of June. So it was very hot, a bit like the Australian Open at the moment sort of temperatures. And there's two sounds, one of which is me walking up the dune, and it sounds a bit like a tuba playing, and it's hard work, I can tell you. And that's the burping sound, which you need very special dunes, and they have to burp and make this sound if they're going to make the next sound, which is the drone. And that's the famous one. And it was written by, Charles Darwin wrote about it, Marco Polo wrote about it. And it's when you slide down, you create an avalanche. And you actually go down on your backside creating an avalanche. You can feel the whole dune vibrating. It makes a drone a bit, well, you'll hear it's a bit like a taxiing aircraft. It's quite low frequency. So if you've got a laptop, it may not come through. You might need to put headphones on.
So where do we need to start with? You sliding down or going back up?
Let's do going back up first.
So that was the burping sound.
That's the burping sound. So it's prerequisite for the next sound, which is when you actually create an avalanche by scooting down the hill.
I'm finding these sounds very soothing, actually.
That's amazing.
I'm really liking that. I like the way he got away with calling it burping.
Now,
that wasn't burping, was it?
Tell me, you say there's only 30 of these sand dunes. How did people find them?
Well, I think some were known about. So, as I said, some writers found about them, and you can read them back in old chronicles. And then some scientists have gone to find more to find out, because there's a big mystery about why they quite sing like this, because it's very few. You have to have the grains of the sand have to all be very similar size. So there's a weird sort of wind movement to sift these sand grains so that all are kind of the same size when they land on, that was the Kelso dunes. And if they don't, they're not sifted rightly, right? They just don't make that sound. And then they've got to be very dry, so that's the reason you have to go in June. And then they have to have the right coating on the grain, so they have to have a salty sort of coating on as well. So it's a sort of weird combination of things. So scientists have seeked them out now to experiment on.
Even natural musicians have a lot of things on their rider, don't they, Andrew? Demanding. The book is Sonic Wonderland, A Scientific Odyssey of Sound. The author is Trevor Cox. Thank you so much for talking us through it, Trevor. Thanks for coming on.
Up next, we'll find out why stuffing dead animals is suddenly the hottest trend around. I'm not sure if that's true, but we'll find out.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
You may or may not have guessed it, but preparing and stuffing dead animals is apparently one of the hottest trends of recent times. Before Christmas, a do-it-yourself guide to taxidermy titled A Field Guide 1 sold out in moments. The illustrative step-by-step guide offered beginners everything they needed for taxidermy at home, except, of course, the dead animals.
It is, however, recommended that beginners to taxidermy start small on things like mice or even guinea pigs. Then, if you're brave enough, you can try your hand at rabbits or maybe even your dear departed dog. A series of workshops on taxidermy in London sold out quickly, and classes up until June are also filling rapidly. One of the women behind the workshops and the do-it-yourself guide is Margot Magpie, very good name there, an accomplished taxidermist who even created stuffed crows for Lana Del Rey's tour. We're delighted to say we're joined in the studio by Margot and the odd dead mouse. Welcome to the show. Could you just tell me, first of all, there's a little fella sitting in front of me, a little white mouse playing a guitar.
Yeah, he's actually featured on the back of the book. I've brought the book, but there he is, a little famous.
He is quite famous, isn't he? What's his name?
Alfred.
Alfred, you just made that up, didn't you?
I was thinking if I had to
christen him on the spot, I'd go for Errol. I don't know why. But there
Errol.
Is. Errol.
We could change his name, I guess. Errol Alfred.
Okay.
Now, we know there was kind of a great era of taxidermy in Victorian times, and you, I guess, into Edwardian times still, and you still go into pubs and see stuffed ferrets and pheasants and fish. But why the resurgence of interest, do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, there's a resurgence in interest in Victoriana. So people are interested in the culture of Victoriana. They're interested in specifically death, I think, because Victoriana was so obsessed with death. It was an everyday part of life. I think people sort of see the resurgence of this and Walter Potter kind of go hand in hand. Walter Potter was a famous Victorian, well, famous now, not at the time, really. But he did dioramas of animals doing human things like rat police raids.
And that's your interest in is having mice potentially play a guitar. Or I see there's another one.
I've got one here. I've got one in front of me. He's doing a bit of haberdashery. He's in the haberdashery department. John Lewis is there or something. I think he is. Isn't he? What is he doing?
He's a tailor mouse. Yeah.
Tailor mouse. Tailor mouse. I love these ones. It is a thing, isn't it? I like the idea of it being sort of a fascination with death and with preserving things, I suppose. What are we going to see next? I've got a funny feeling that embalming's going to catch on. Maybe not. Maybe that's the next. Maybe
I
that's
think
a
the
step
next thing is
far.
Freeze drying. In America, they've started freeze drying people's pets.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it sucks all the moisture out.
And this is presumably in the
after
hope
they've
that they
died,
can be...
we hasten to act.
Yes.
Now, the success of your book and the guide, it does leave one question. Where do you get the mouse?
The mice are sourced from reptile feed. You feed snakes.
Oh, these mice are bred
They're
for snakes.
They're frozen, yeah.
Okay.
You can buy them pre-froze.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's mice on ice. and you can get those at any pet
that
shop,
sounds,
basically.
Matt, what kind of... That sounds like a rider from like Alice Cooper or like Ozzy Osbourne back in the day. Mice on Ice. I'd like to know how you started. How did you get into it, and what was the first thing you stuffed, and what's the biggest thing you stuffed?
Well, I I had really, I don't know, I must be like, I don't know if I'm just have morbid interests or something, yeah. but I was really interested in the history of taxidermy. Yeah. And the Natural History Museum has saber-toothed tiger, which doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
You know, you can't get a viable saber-toothed tiger body these days.
Viable. These days. When you say these days, you mean in the last million years.
I like yes, that. I like exactly. That.
I'd love to see your calendar.
So I thought the creativity in putting together a tiger that was a saber-toothed tiger was just so cool and creative. Uh-huh. And it looked so convincing. And, you know, as a child, I'm like, wow, that's amazing. So I kind of just remembered that. And, you know, I saw that you were able to go and practice with professional taxidermists. So I decided to do that.
And Margot, your dress is a little bit on the edge of Gothic, and you've got glitter, and you've got red hair, and a dinosaur a necklace as well. Is it a bit of a, you've already said that the Victoriana interests many people. Is this a world that you're enchanted by as well?
Kind of. I really like to promote conversation around death. And Victoriana, I guess, but more so around death. I'm really interested in how people perceive it. And I think that these courses are kind of, people see it as a taboo these days. And in Victorian culture, it was every day. So people kind of see that now and it's a bit, ooh, look at that. That's a bit weird. I want to try it. It's a novelty. And so I think that I really like to bring that to every day. And so that people can be exposed to that and start conversation about it.
Could you just give us maybe in like three or four pointers, the top tips for stuffing a mouse?
Top tips.
So what do? You first remove the body?
Yeah. So you remove the insides. So you're gutting and skinning the mouse, basically. Then you're washing.
I've got a scalpel on my desk, actually. I've been used to opening my post with Andrew. You can borrow it anytime you want.
Step two.
Washing. So bath and blow dry.
Okay. Inside and out.
Be careful not to be too hot, right?
Yeah, not too hot. Yeah. Good. See, you're on it.
I'm writing this down. I'm intrigued.
Step three.
Would be preserving it. So using the preservatives on the skin and usually a bit of borax to dry up any extra muscle and dry up any excess liquid.
And then you begin to stuff it,
And then you stuff it.
With?
Usually wood wool or cotton wool. Wool yarn.
And then do you need to be
wires.
Good at sewing? Because I can't see any stitches on my little friend.
Yeah, you don't have to really be good at sewing. It's okay.
But he is stitched together.
So you're sewing them
together.
Up the top. They are stitched together, but the skin kind of fuses back together. So if you were really bad at it, you could just remove the stitches later on.
And is that actually his tail or a piece of string?
It's his tail. Oh. Feel it. Touch it.
Oh, yeah, it's bony.
Ooh. Yes. Ooh.
Bony, isn't it? I like this idea, you know, the anthropomorphization of these things, giving them human qualities. Can you kind of rescue the reputation of something? We just talked about, oh, he looks a bit weaselly, he looked a bit stoaty. Can we rescue the reputation of a weasel by making him do something great? Like, in taxidermy form, helping an old lady across the road. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, mice are sort of cute, rats aren't cute.
Give him like a little cape and he could be like Weasel Man.
Weasel Man, you know, he could be helping an elderly stoat across the road.
And is there a business in this? Are you doing kind of banjo playing mice and stoats to order? Or?
Well, I get commissions and stuff.
Let's ask you about Lana Del Rey. So she came to you to ask for, I nearly misread it, I said in the script, I nearly said cows, but it's crows. She came to you for some crows for her album
cover.
Yeah,
well, her people came to us.
Her people, okay.
Just for props. So she wanted props of crows holding jewellery on her European stage tour. So we made the crows.
And have you got any other good commissions on the go at the moment? What else are you making for people?
I have sort of some things going on for possibly the Science Museum. I've done a rat for them before for a brain mapping exhibit. Amanda Palmer wore one of my fascinators, which was also crow related.
Uh-huh,
okay. And skull, actually. I have a skull here, which was really cool. It's a bird skull.
Oh, nice. I can see you wearing that. Yeah.
This is a crow.
Yeah.
So this is a crow's head kind of stitched into the middle of a silk red rose.
Yeah. And that clips onto the fascinator, which it was a massive crow's wing, about a foot and a half high.
Rob almost has enough hair for one of these. I think it could be quite fetching.
I was going to have a go on Margot's other one, that little sort of... Well, I think that's slightly more...
And what is there some other...
Oh, this is just like one of the magpie wing. It's a fascinator you wear on your head.
Oh, very nice.
This is a mouse foot brooch.
A mouse foot brooch?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's a... Give me five.
Give me five.
It's kind of come back into. I mean, obviously, as we said at the beginning, the Victoriana element is kind of is all about the Victoriana element, and there's a lot of it in pubs because of that element. Some of it's original. Some pubs are sort of embracing it more and more. There's a pub near where I live, the Hunteress, which is bedecked with taxidermy, and obviously that's a new thing. That's been there only for 4 or 5 years, I guess, in its present state like that. So it's kind of a thing. Have you sort of been in that universe of sort of having to deck out pubs and make this sort of nouveau Victoriana chic thing?
Not so much pubs.
Just drinking just in them, not...
yeah. Right. Just admiring the taxidermy in them.
And Margaret, perhaps you should tell our listeners as well, if they want to get hold of your book, if they want a masterclass in stuffing, where do they go to?
Visit afieldguide.org.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you put in masterclass in stuffing into the internet, Andrew? Do not let me be standing behind your desk when I see what comes up.
Well, Margot, amazing. And I like the mouse very much. I think he gave up his life for a good cause.
Yeah, he did. He's got a little six-string Spanish guitar. Yeah, he's rocking it.
Rather that than ending up down some snake's gullet. I think that I'd rather be him.
Than snake poo.
Yes, and then snake poo. Yeah. Exactly.
That sounds like some sort of tagline, doesn't it? Margot Magpie, thank you so much
for joining us
on The Weekly. And there we have it. Margot was nice, wasn't she?
Yeah, she's great.
You're right, she did have a bit of goth about her. I kind of could imagine her stuffing her.
Now listen, she had a lot of glitter on her face as well. She did a good look for radio.
Yeah, she did. We all see glitter. It was more, she had sort of more like...
No, she had glitter on her cheeks.
I didn't know.
The way the light shone for me.
Oh, I didn't see. I wasn't exposed to her cheeks.
Okay. She looked very nice. She'd made an effort for us.
She had. She looked great. I liked all that. There was a bit of light and shade in that programme.
Yes.
We shouldn't really critique our own programme. People can probably do that for ourselves. But it's nice to be in this studio. Air conditioned as it is up to the hills, it's kind of still nice to be in here.
And you meet some great people. And on a different track, it was wonderful to meet Ned LeBeau, a really amazing guy.
He was an amazing man with a sort of amazing story. He's one of those interviews that just sort of stops you in your tracks.
Yes.
And kind of makes you... Yeah. And I suppose he's in a good position to wonder what would happen if all that stuff hadn't happened.
Yes.
That was it, Andrew. That was 237.
Unusual number. I don't know whether to celebrate it or not. It doesn't quite deserve a bottle of champagne.
I expect someone on University Challenge can tell us what the square root of it is at the drop of a hat. We're not going to bother with that. But we are going to thank Marcus Hippie and Phil Hahn, who are our producers today. And studio manager was Toby Hammond. Thank you, Toby. And we'll be here again next week, probably, won't we, Andrew?
We will be off anywhere.
I think we're both going to be here.
I'm going to be here.
So if you're going to be here, I'm going to be here. Good. Let's not break up a good party. It leaves us just to say thank you very much from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
For tuning in. Thank you.